Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 8. It is only today's lethargic contempt for the pronouncements of our political and intellectual leaders that blinds people to the meaning, implications, and consequences of the notion of government by consensus. You have all heard it, and I suspect dismissed it as politicians' oratory, giving no thought to its actual meaning. But that is what I urge you to consider. A significant clue to that meaning was given in an article by Tom Wicker in the New York Times, October 11, 1964. Referring to what Nelson Rockefeller used to call the mainstream of American thought, Mr. Wicker writes, "That mainstream is what political theorists have been projecting for years as the national consensus, what Walter Lippmann has aptly called the vital center. Political moderation, almost by definition, is at the heart of a consensus. That is, the consensus generally sprawls over all acceptable political views, all ideas that are not totally repugnant to and do not directly threaten some major segment of the population. Therefore, acceptable ideas must take the views of others into account, and that is what is meant by moderation." Now let us identify what this means. The consensus generally sprawls over all acceptable political views. Acceptable to whom? To the consensus. And since the government is to be ruled by the consensus, this means that political views are to be divided into those which are acceptable and those which are unacceptable to the government. What would be the criterion of acceptability? Mr. Wicker supplies it. Observe that the criterion is not intellectual, not a question of whether certain views are true or false. The criterion is not moral, not a question of whether the views are right or wrong. The criterion is emotional, whether the views are or are not repugnant. To whom? To some major segment of the population. There is also the additional proviso that these views must not directly threaten that major segment. What about the minor segments of the population? Are the views that threaten them acceptable? What about the smallest segment, the individual? Obviously, the individual and the minority groups are not to be considered. No matter how repugnant an idea may be to a man, and no matter how gravely it may threaten his life, his work, his future, he is to be ignored or sacrificed by the omnipotent consensus and its government, unless he has a gang, a sizable gang, to support him. What exactly is a direct threat to any part of the population? In a mixed economy, every government action is a direct threat to some men and an indirect threat to all. Every government interference in the economy consists of giving an unearned benefit, extorted by force, to some men at the expense of others. By what criterion of justice is a consensus government to be guided? By the size of the victim's gang. Now note Mr. Wicker's last sentence. Therefore, acceptable ideas must take the views of others into account, and that is what is meant by moderation. And just what is meant here by the views of others? Of which others? Since it is not the views of individuals nor of minorities, the only discernible meaning is that every other major segment must take into account the views of all the other major segments. But suppose that a group of socialists wants to nationalize all factories, and a group of industrialists wants to keep its properties. What would it mean for either group to take into account the views of the other? And what would moderation consist of in such a case? What would constitute moderation in a conflict between a group of men who want to be supported at public expense and a group of taxpayers who have other uses for their money? What would constitute moderation in a conflict between the member of a smaller group, such as a Negro in the South, who believes that he has an inalienable right to a fair trial, and the larger group of Southern racists who believe that the public good of their community permits them to lynch him? What would constitute moderation in a conflict between me and a communist, or between our respective followers, when my views are that I have an inalienable right to my life, liberty, and happiness, and his views are that the public good of the state permits him to rob, enslave, or murder me? There can be no meeting ground, no middle, no compromise between opposite principles. There can be no such thing as moderation in the realm of reason and of morality. But reason and morality are precisely the two concepts abrogated by the notion of government by consensus. The advocates of that notion would declare at this point that any idea which permits no compromise constitutes extremism, that any form of extremism, any uncompromising stand, is evil, that the consensus sprawls only over those ideas which are amenable to moderation, and that moderation is the supreme virtue, superseding reason and morality. This is the clue to the core, essence, motive, and real meaning of the doctrine of government by consensus, the cult of compromise. Compromise is the precondition, the necessity, the imperative of a mixed economy. The consensus doctrine is an attempt to translate the brute facts of a mixed economy into an ideological or anti-ideological system and to provide them with a semblance of justification. A mixed economy is a mixture of freedom and controls, with no principles, rules, or theories to define either. Since the introduction of controls necessitates and leads to further controls, it is an unstable, explosive mixture, which ultimately has to repeal the controls or collapse into dictatorship. A mixed economy has no principles to define its policies, its goals, its laws, no principles to limit the power of its government. The only principle of a mixed economy, which necessarily has to remain unnamed and unacknowledged, is that no one's interests are safe. Everyone's interests are on a public auction block, and anything goes for anyone who can get away with it. Such a system, or more precisely anti-system, breaks up a country into an ever-growing number of enemy camps, into economic groups fighting one another for self-preservation in an indeterminate mixture of defense and offense, as the nature of such a jungle demands. While politically a mixed economy preserves the semblance of an organized society with a semblance of law and order, economically it is the equivalent of the chaos that had ruled China for centuries, a chaos of robber gangs looting and draining the productive elements of the country. A mixed economy is ruled by pressure groups. It is an amoral, institutionalized civil war of special interests and lobbies, all fighting to seize a momentary control of the legislative machinery, to extort some special privilege at one another's expense by an act of government, i.e. by force. In the absence of individual rights, in the absence of any moral or legal principles, a mixed economy's only hope to preserve its precarious semblance of order, to restrain the savage, desperately rapacious groups it itself has created, and to prevent the legalized plunder from running over into plain unlegalized looting of all by all, is compromise. Compromise on everything and in every realm, material, spiritual, intellectual, so that no group would step over the line by demanding too much and topple the whole rotted structure. If the game is to continue, nothing can be permitted to remain firm, solid, absolute, untouchable. Everything and everyone has to be fluid, flexible, indeterminate, approximate. By what standard are anyone's actions to be guided? By the expediency of any immediate moment. The only danger to a mixed economy is any not-to-be-compromised value, virtue, or idea. The only threat is any uncompromising person, group, or movement. The only enemy is integrity. It is unnecessary to point out who will be the steady winners and who the constant losers in a game of that kind. It is also clear what sort of unity, of consensus, that game requires. The unity of a tacit agreement that anything goes, anything is for sale or for negotiation, and the rest is up for the free-for-all of pressuring, lobbying, manipulating, favor-swapping, public relationing, give-and-taking, double-crossing, begging, bribing, betraying, and chance, the blind chance, of a war in which the prize is the privilege of using legal armed force against legally disarmed victims. Observe that this type of prize establishes one basic interest held in common by all the players, the desire to have a strong government. A government of unlimited power, strong enough to let the winners and would-be winners get away with whatever they're seeking. A government uncommitted to any policy, unrestrained by any ideology, a government that hoards an ever-growing power, power for power's sake, which means for the sake and use of any major gang who might seize it momentarily to ram their particular piece of legislation down the country's throat. Observe, therefore, that the doctrine of compromise and moderation applies to everything except one issue, any suggestion to limit the power of the government. Observe the torrents of vilification, abuse, and hysterical hatred unleashed by the moderates against any advocate of freedom, i.e. of capitalism. Observe that such designations as extreme middle or militant middle are being used by people seriously and self-righteously. Observe the inordinately vicious intensity of the smear campaign against Senator Goldwater, which had the overtones of panic, the panic of the moderates, the vital centrists, the middle of the roaders, in the face of the possibility that a real pro-capitalism movement might put an end to their game. A movement, incidentally, which does not exist as yet, since Senator Goldwater was not an advocate of capitalism, and since his meaningless, unphilosophical, unintellectual campaign has contributed to the entrenchment of the consensus advocates. But what is significant here is the nature of their panic. It gave us a glimpse of their vaunted moderation, their democratic respect for the people's choices, and their tolerance of disagreements or opposition. In a letter to the New York Times, June 23, 1964, an assistant professor of political science, fearing Goldwater's nomination, wrote as follows: "The real danger lies in the divisive campaign which his nomination would provoke. The result of a Goldwater candidacy would be a divided and embittered electorate, and to be effective, American government requires a high degree of consensus and bipartisanship on basic issues. When and by whom has statism been accepted as the basic principle of America, and as a principle which should now be placed beyond debate or dissension, so that no basic issues are to be raised any longer? Isn't that the formula of a one-party government?" The professor did not specify. Another letter writer in the New York Times, June 24, 1964, identified in print as a liberal Democrat, went a little farther. "Let the American people choose in November. If they choose overwhelmingly for Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats, then once and for all the federal government can get on with no excuses with the job millions of Negroes, unemployed, aged, sick, and otherwise handicapped persons expect it to do, to say nothing of our overseas commitments. If the people choose Goldwater, then it would seem the nation was hardly worth saving after all. Woodrow Wilson once said that there is such a thing as being too proud to fight. Then he had to go to war. Once and for all, let us have it out, while the battle yet can be fought with ballots instead of bullets." Does this gentleman mean that if we don't vote his way, he will resort to bullets? Your guess is as good as mine. The New York Times, which had been a conspicuous advocate of government by consensus, said some curious things in its comment on President Johnson's victory. Its editorial of November 8, 1964 stated, "No matter how massive the electoral victory, and it was massive, the administration cannot merely ride the crest of the popular wave, rolling along on a sea of platitudinous generalizations and euphoric promises. Now that it has a broad popular mandate, it has the moral as well as the political obligation not to try to be all things to all men, but to settle down to a hard, concrete, purposeful course of action." What kind of purposeful action? If the voters were offered nothing but platitudinous generalizations and euphoric promises, how can their vote be taken as a broad popular mandate? A mandate for an unnamed purpose? A political blank check? And if Mr. Johnson did win a massive victory by trying to be all things to all men, then which things is he now expected to be? Which voters is he to disappoint or betray? And what becomes of the broad popular consensus? Morally and philosophically, that editorial is highly dubious and contradictory. But it becomes clear and consistent in the context of a mixed economy's anti-ideology. The president of a mixed economy is not expected to have a specific program or policy. A blank check on power is all that he asks the voters to give him. Thereafter, it's up to the pressure group game. which everybody is supposed to understand and endorse, but never mention. Which things he will be to which men depends on the chances of the game, and on the major segments of the population. His job is only to hold the power, and to dispense the favors. In the 1930s, the liberals had a program of broad social reforms and a crusading spirit. They advocated a planned society. They talked in terms of abstract principles. They propounded theories of a predominantly socialistic nature, and most of them were touchy about the accusation that they were enlarging the government's power. Most of them were assuring their opponents that government power was only a temporary means to an end, a noble end, the liberation of the individual from his bondage to material needs. Today, nobody talks of a planned society in the liberal camp. Long-range programs, theories, principles, abstractions, and noble ends are not fashionable any longer. Modern liberals deride any political concern with such large-scale matters as an entire society or an economy as a whole. They concern themselves with single, concrete-bound, range-of-the-moment projects and demands, without regard to cost, context, or consequences. Pragmatic, not idealistic, is their favorite adjective when they are called upon to justify their stance, as they call it, not stand. They are militantly opposed to political philosophy. They denounce political concepts as tags, labels, myths, illusions, and resist any attempt to label, i.e. to identify, their own views. They are belligerently anti-theoretical, and with a faded mantle of intellectuality still clinging to their shoulders, they are anti-intellectual. The only remnant of their former idealism is a tired, cynical, ritualistic quoting of shop-worn humanitarian slogans when the occasion demands it. Cynicism, uncertainty, and fear are the insignia of the culture which they are still dominating by default. And the only thing that has not rusted in their ideological equipment, but has grown savagely brighter and clearer through the years, is their lust for power, for an autocratic, statist, totalitarian government power. It is not a crusading brightness. It is not the lust of a fanatic with a mission. It is more like the glassy-eyed brightness of a somnambulist, whose stuporous despair has long since swallowed the memory of his purpose, but who still clings to his mystic weapon in the stubborn belief that there ought to be a law, that everything will be all right if only somebody will pass a law, that every problem can be solved by the magic power of brute force. Such is the present intellectual state and ideological trend of our culture. Now I shall ask you to consider the question I raised at the beginning of this discussion. Which of these two variants of statism are we moving toward? Socialism or fascism? Let me submit in evidence, as part of the answer, a quotation from an editorial that appeared in the Washington Star, October 1964. It is an eloquent mixture of truth and misinformation, and a typical example of the state of today's political knowledge. Socialism is quite simply the state ownership of the means of production. This has never been proposed by a major party candidate for the presidency, and is not now proposed by Lyndon Johnson. True. There is, however, a whole series of American legislative acts that increase either government regulation of private business or government responsibility for individual welfare. True. It is to such legislation that warning cries of socialism refer. Besides the constitutional provision for federal regulation of interstate commerce, such intrusion of government into the marketplace begins with the antitrust laws. Very true. To them we owe the continued existence of competitive capitalism and the non-arrival of cartel capitalism. Untrue. Inasmuch as socialism is the product, one way or another, of cartel capitalism, untrue, it may reasonably be said that such government interference with business has in fact prevented socialism. Worse than untrue. As to welfare legislation, it is still light years away from the cradle-to-grave security sponsored by contemporary socialism. Not quite true. It seems much more like ordinary human concern for human distress than like an ideological program of any kind. The last part of this sentence is true. It is not an ideological program. As to the first part, ordinary human concern for human distress does not manifest itself ordinarily in the form of a gun aimed at the wallets and earnings of one's neighbors. This editorial did not mention, of course, that a system in which the government does not nationalize the means of production but assumes total control over the economy is fascism. It is true that the welfare statists are not socialists, that they never advocated or intended the socialization of private property, that they want to preserve private property, with government control of its use and disposal. But that is the fundamental characteristic of fascism. Here is another piece of evidence. This one is less crudely naive than the first, and much more insidiously wrong. This is from a letter to the New York Times, November 1, 1964, written by an assistant professor of economics. Viewed by almost every yardstick, the United States today is more committed to private enterprise than probably any other industrial country, and is not even remotely approaching a socialist system. As the term is understood by students of comparative economic systems and others who do not use it loosely, socialism is identified with extensive nationalization, a dominant public sector, a strong cooperative movement, egalitarian income distribution, a total welfare state, and central planning. In the United States, not only has there been no nationalization, but government concerns have been turned over to private enterprise. Income distribution in this country is one of the most unequal among the developed nations, and tax cuts and tax loopholes have blunted the moderate progressivity of our tax structure. 30 years after the New Deal, the United States has a very limited welfare state, compared with the comprehensive social security and public housing schemes in many European countries. By no stretch of the imagination is the real issue in this campaign a choice between capitalism and socialism, or between a free and a planned economy. The issue is about two differing concepts of the role of government within the framework of an essentially private enterprise system. The role of government in a private enterprise system is that of a policeman who protects man's individual rights, including property rights, by protecting men from physical force. In a free economy, the government does not control, regulate, coerce, or interfere with men's economic activities. I do not know the political views of the writer of that letter. He may be a liberal, or he may be an alleged defender of capitalism, but if he is this last, then I must point out that such views as his, which are shared by many conservatives, are more damaging and derogatory to capitalism than the ideas of its avowed enemies. Such conservatives regard capitalism as a system compatible with government controls and thus help to spread the most dangerous misconceptions. While full laissez-faire capitalism has not yet existed anywhere, while some unnecessary government controls were allowed to dilute and undercut the original American system more through error than through theoretical intention, such controls were minor impediments. The mixed economies of the 19th century were predominantly free, and it is this unprecedented freedom that brought about mankind's unprecedented progress. The principles, the theory, and the actual practice of capitalism rest on a free, unregulated market, as the history of the last two centuries has amply demonstrated. No defender of capitalism can permit himself to ignore the exact meaning of the term laissez-faire and of the term mixed economy, which clearly indicates the two opposite elements involved in the mixture: the element of economic freedom, which is capitalism, and the element of government controls, which is statism. An insistent campaign has been going on for years to make us accept the Marxist view that all governments are tools of economic class interests, and that capitalism is not a free economy, but a system of government controls serving some privileged class. The purpose of that campaign is to distort economics, rewrite history, and obliterate the existence and the possibility of a free country and an uncontrolled economy. Since a system of nominal private property ruled by government controls is not capitalism but fascism, the only choice this obliteration would leave us is the choice between fascism and socialism, or communism, which all the statists in the world of all varieties, degrees, and denominations are struggling frantically to make us believe. The destruction of freedom is their common goal, after which they hope to fight one another for power. It is thus that the views of that professor and of many conservatives lend credence and support to the vicious leftist propaganda which equates capitalism with fascism. But there is a bitter kind of justice in the logic of events. That propaganda is having an effect which may be advantageous to the communists, but which is the opposite of the effect intended by the liberals, the welfare statists, the socialists, who share the guilt of spreading it. Instead of smearing capitalism, that propaganda has succeeded in whitewashing and disguising fascism. In this country, few people care to advocate, to defend, or even to understand capitalism. Yet fewer still wish to give up its advantages. So if they are told that capitalism is compatible with controls, with the particular controls which further their particular interests, be it government handouts or minimum wages or price supports or subsidies or antitrust laws or censorship of dirty movies, they will go along with such programs in the comforting belief that the results will be nothing worse than a modified capitalism. And thus a country which does abhor fascism is moving by imperceptible degrees, through ignorance, confusion, evasion, moral cowardice, and intellectual default, not towards socialism or any mawkish altruistic ideal, but toward a plain, brutal, predatory, power-grubbing, de facto fascism. No, we have not reached that stage, but we are certainly not an essentially private enterprise system any longer. At present, we are a disintegrating, unsound, precariously unstable mixed economy, a random, mongrel mixture of socialistic schemes, communistic influences, fascist controls, and shrinking remnants of capitalism still paying the costs of it all. The total of it rolling in the direction of a fascist state. Consider our present administration. I don't think I'll be accused of unfairness if I say that President Johnson is not a philosophical thinker. No, he is not a fascist. He is not a socialist. He is not a pro-capitalist. Ideologically, he is not anything in particular. Judging by his past record and by the consensus of his own supporters, the concept of an ideology is not applicable in his case. He is a politician. A very dangerous, yet very appropriate phenomenon in our present state. He is an almost fiction-like, archetypical embodiment of the perfect leader of a mixed economy, a man who enjoys power for power's sake, who is expert at the game of manipulating pressure groups, of playing them all against one another, who loves the process of dispensing smiles, frowns, and favors, particularly sudden favors, and whose vision does not extend beyond the range of the next election. Neither President Johnson nor any of today's prominent groups would advocate the socialization of industry. Like his modern predecessors in office, Mr. Johnson knows that businessmen are the milk cows of a mixed economy, and he does not want to destroy them. He wants them to prosper and to feed his welfare projects, which the next election requires, while they, the businessmen, are eating out of his hand as they seem to be anxiously eager to do. The business lobby is certain to get its fair share of influence and of recognition, just like the labor lobby or the farm lobby or the lobby of any major segment, on his own terms. He will be particularly adept at the task of creating and encouraging the type of businessmen whom I call the aristocracy of pull. This is not a socialistic pattern. It is the typical pattern of fascism. The political, intellectual, and moral meaning of Mr. Johnson's policy toward businessmen was summed up eloquently in an article in the New York Times of January 4, 1965. Mr. Johnson is an out-and-out Keynesian in his assiduous wooing of the business community. Unlike President Roosevelt, who delighted in attacking businessmen until World War II forced him into a reluctant truce, and President Kennedy, who also incurred business hostility. President Johnson has worked long and hard to get businessmen to join ranks in a national consensus for his programs. This campaign may perturb many Keynesians, but it is pure Keynes. Indeed, Lord Keynes, who once was regarded as a dangerous and Machiavellian figure by American businessmen, made specific suggestions for improving relations between the president and the business community. He set down his views in 1938 in a letter to President Roosevelt, who was running into renewed criticism from businessmen following the recession that took place the previous year. Lord Keynes, who always sought to transform capitalism in order to save it, recognized the importance of business confidence and tried to convince Mr. Roosevelt to repair the damage that had been done. He advised the president that businessmen were not politicians and did not respond to the same treatment. They are, he wrote, much milder than politicians, at the same time allured and terrified by the glare of publicity, easily persuaded to be patriots, perplexed, bemused, indeed terrified, yet only too anxious to take a cheerful view, vain perhaps, but very unsure of themselves, pathetically responsive to a kind word. He was confident that Mr. Roosevelt could tame them and make them do his bidding, provided he followed some simple Keynesian rules. "You could do anything you liked with them," the letter continued, "if you would treat them, even the big ones, not as wolves and tigers, but as domestic animals by nature, even though they have been badly brought up and not trained as you would wish." President Roosevelt ignored his advice, so apparently did President Kennedy. But President Johnson seems to have got the message. By kind words and frequent pats on the head, he had had the business community eating out of his hand. Mr. Johnson appears to agree with Lord Keynes's view that there is little to be gained by carrying on a feud with businessmen. As he put it, "If you work them into the surly, obstinate, terrified mood of which domestic animals, wrongly handled, are capable, the nation's burden will not get carried to market, and in the end public opinion will veer their way." The view of businessmen as domestic animals who carry the nation's burden and who must be trained by the president to do his bidding is certainly not a view compatible with capitalism. It is not a view applicable to socialism, since there are no businessmen in a socialist state. It is a view that expresses the economic essence of fascism, of the relationship between business and government in a fascist state. No matter what the verbal camouflage, such is the actual meaning of any variant of transformed or modified or modernized or humanized capitalism. In all such doctrines, the humanization consists of turning some members of society, the most productive ones, into beasts of burden. The formula by which the sacrificial animals are to be fooled and tamed is being repeated today with growing insistence and frequency. Businessmen, it is said, must regard the government not as an enemy, but as a partner. The notion of a partnership between a private group and public officials, between business and government, between production and force, is a linguistic corruption, an anti-concept typical of a fascist ideology, an ideology that regards force as the basic element and ultimate arbiter in all human relationships. Partnership is an indecent euphemism for government control. There can be no partnership between armed bureaucrats and defenseless private citizens who have no choice but to obey. What chance would you have against a partner whose arbitrary word is law, who may give you a hearing if your pressure group is big enough, but who will play favorites and bargain your interests away, who will always have the last word and the legal right to enforce it on you at the point of a gun, holding your property, your work, your future, your life in his power? Is that the meaning of partnership? But there are men who may find such a prospect attractive. They exist among businessmen as among every other group or profession. The men who dread the competition of a free market and would welcome an armed partner to extort special advantages over their abler competitors. Men who seek to rise not by merit, but by pull. Men who are willing and eager to live not by right, but by favor. Among businessmen, this type of mentality was responsible for the passage of the antitrust laws and is still supporting them today. A substantial number of Republican businessmen switched to the side of Mr. Johnson in the last election. Here are some interesting observations on this subject from a survey by the New York Times, September 16, 1964. Interviews in five cities in the industrial Northeast and Midwest disclose striking differences in political outlook between officials of large corporations and men who operate smaller businesses. The business executives who expect to cast the first Democratic presidential vote of their lives are nearly all affiliated with large companies. There is more support for President Johnson among business executives who are in their 40s and 50s than there is among either older or younger businessmen. Many businessmen in their 40s and 50s say they find relatively little shifting towards support of Mr. Johnson on the part of younger business executives. Interviews with those in their 30s confirm this. The younger executives themselves speak with pride of their generation as the one that interrupted and reversed the trend toward more liberalism in younger persons. It is on the issue of government deficits that the division of opinion between small and large businessmen emerges most dramatically. Officials of giant corporations have a far greater tendency to accept the idea that budget deficits are sometimes necessary and even desirable. The typical small businessman, however, reserves a very special scorn for deficit spending. This gives us an indication of who are the vested interests in a mixed economy and what such an economy does to the beginners or the young. An essential aspect of the socialistically inclined mentality is the desire to obliterate the difference between the earned and the unearned, and therefore to permit no differentiation between such businessmen as Hank Reardon and Orrin Boyle. To a concrete-bound, range-of-the-moment, primitive socialist mentality, a mentality that clamors for a redistribution of wealth without any concern for the origin of wealth, the enemy is all those who are rich, regardless of the source of their riches. Such mentalities, those aging, graying liberals who had been the idealists of the 30s, are clinging desperately to the illusion that we are moving toward some sort of socialist state inimical to the rich and beneficial to the poor, while frantically evading the spectacle of what kind of rich are being destroyed and what kind are flourishing under the system they, the liberals, have established. The grim joke is on them. Their alleged ideals have paved the way not towards socialism, but toward fascism. The collector of their efforts is not the helplessly, brainlessly virtuous little man of their flat-footed imagination and shop-worn fiction, but the worst type of predatory rich, the rich by force, the rich by political privilege, the type who has no chance under capitalism, but who is always there to cash in on every collectivist noble experiment. It is the creators of wealth, the Hank Reardons, who are destroyed under any form of statism, socialist, communist, or fascist. It is the parasites, the Orrin Boyles, who are the privileged elite and the profiteers of statism, particularly of fascism. The special profiteers of socialism are the James Taggarts, of communism, the Floyd Ferrises. The same is true of their psychological counterparts among the poor and among the men of all the economic levels in between. The particular form of economic organization, which is becoming more and more apparent in this country as an outgrowth of the power of pressure groups, is one of the worst variants of statism, guild socialism. Guild socialism robs the talented young of their future by freezing men into professional castes under rigid rules. It represents an open embodiment of the basic motive of most statists, though they usually prefer not to confess it. The entrenchment and protection of mediocrity from abler competitors, the shackling of the men of superior ability down to the mean average of their professions. That theory is not too popular among socialists, though it has its advocates. But the most famous instance of its large-scale practice was fascist Italy. In the 1930s, a few perceptive men said that Roosevelt's New Deal was a form of guild socialism, and it was closer to Mussolini's system than to any other. They were ignored. Today, the evidence is unmistakable. It was also said that if fascism ever came to the United States, it would come disguised as socialism. In this connection, I recommend that you read or reread Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, with special reference to the character, style, and ideology of Berzelius Windrip, the fascist leader. Now let me mention and answer some of the standard objections by which today's liberals attempt to camouflage, to differentiate from fascism, the nature of the system they are supporting. Fascism requires one-party rule. What will the notion of government by consensus amount to in practice? Fascism's goal is the conquest of the world. What is the goal of those global-minded bipartisan champions of the United Nations? And if they reach it, what positions do they expect to acquire in the power structure of one world? Fascism preaches racism. Not necessarily. Hitler's Germany did. Mussolini's Italy did not. Fascism is opposed to the welfare state. Check your premises and your history books. The father and originator of the welfare state, the man who put into practice the notion of buying the loyalty of some groups with money extorted from others, was Bismarck, the political ancestor of Hitler. Let me remind you that the full title of the Nazi Party was the National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany. Let me remind you also of some excerpts from the political program of that party, adopted in Munich on February 24, 1920. We ask that the government undertake the obligation above all of providing citizens with adequate opportunity for employment and earning a living. The activities of the individual must not be allowed to clash with the interests of the community, but must take place within its confines and be for the good of all. Therefore, we demand an end to the power of the financial interests. We demand profit sharing in big business. We demand a broad extension of care for the aged. We demand the greatest possible consideration of small business in the purchases of the national, state, and municipal governments. In order to make possible to every capable and industrious citizen the attainment of higher education and thus the achievement of a post of leadership, the government must provide an all-around enlargement of our entire system of public education. We demand the education at government expense of gifted children of poor parents. The government must undertake the improvement of public health by protecting mother and child, by prohibiting child labor, by the greatest possible support for all clubs concerned with the physical education of youth. We combat the materialistic spirit within and without us, and are convinced that a permanent recovery of our people can only proceed from within on the foundation of the common good before the individual good. There is, however, one difference between the type of fascism toward which we are drifting and the type that ravaged European countries. Ours is not a militant kind of fascism, not an organized movement of shrill demagogues, bloody thugs, hysterical third-rate intellectuals, and juvenile delinquents. Ours is a tired, worn, cynical fascism, fascism by default. Not like a flaming disaster, but more like the quiet collapse of a lethargic body slowly eaten by internal corruption. Did it have to happen? No. Can it still be averted? Yes. If you doubt the power of philosophy to set the course and shape the destiny of human societies, observe that our mixed economy is the literal, faithfully carried out product of pragmatism and of the generation brought up under its influence. Pragmatism is the philosophy which holds that there is no objective reality or permanent truth, that there are no absolute principles, no valid abstractions, no firm concepts, that anything may be tried by rule of thumb, that objectivity consists of collective subjectivism, that whatever people wish to be true is true, whatever people wish to exist does exist, provided a consensus says so. If you want to avert the final disaster, it is this type of thinking, every one of those propositions and all of them, that you must face, grasp, and reject. Then you will have grasped the connection of philosophy to politics and to the daily events of your life. Then you will have learned that no society is better than its philosophical foundation. And then, to paraphrase John Galt, you will be ready not to return to capitalism, but to discover it. Chapter 21, The Wreckage of the Consensus, by Ayn Rand. 2 years ago, on April 18, 1965, I spoke at this forum on the subject of the new fascism, rule by Congress. I said, the clue to the core, essence, motive, and real meaning of the doctrine of government by consensus is the cult of compromise. Compromise is the precondition, the necessity, the imperative of a mixed economy. The consensus doctrine is an attempt to translate the brute facts of a mixed economy into an ideological or anti-ideological system and to provide them with a semblance of justification. The brute facts of a mixed economy are gang rule, i.e. a scramble for power by various pressure groups, without any moral or political principles, without any program, direction, purpose, or long-range goal, with the tacit belief in rule by force as their only common denominator, and unless the trend is changed, a fascist state as the ultimate result. In September of 1965, writing in the Objectivist newsletter, I said, contrary to the fanatical belief of its advocates, compromise does not satisfy, but dissatisfies everyone. It does not lead to general fulfillment, but to general frustration. Those who try to be all things to all men end up by not being anything to anyone. It is startling to observe how rapidly this principle took effect in an age that takes no cognizance of principles. Where is President Johnson's consensus today, and where politically is President Johnson? To descend in 2 years in an era of seeming prosperity without the push of any obvious national disaster, to descend from the height of a popular landslide to the status of a liability to his own party in the elections of 1966, is a feat that should give pause to anyone concerned with modern politics. If there were any way to make compromise work, President Johnson is the man who would have done it. He was an expert at the game of manipulating pressure groups, a game that consists of making promises and friends, and keeping the second but not the first. His skill as a manipulator was the one characteristic that his public image builders were selling us at the height of his popularity. If he could not make it, no amateur can. The practical efficacy of compromise is the first premise that Johnson's history should prompt people to check. And I believe a great many people are checking it. People, but not Republicans, or at least not all of them, not those who are now pushing an unformed, soft-shelled thing like Romney to succeed where a pro has failed. What are we left with now that the consensus has collapsed? Nothing but the open spectacle of a mixed economy's intellectual and moral bankruptcy, the random wreckage of its naked mechanism, with the screeching of its gears as the only sound in our public silence. The sound of crude, range-of-the-moment demands by pressure groups who have abandoned even the pretense at any political ideals or moral justification. The consensus doctrine was a disguise, a shoddy cheesecloth one, but still a disguise, to give a semblance of theoretical status to the practice of plain gang warfare. Today, even the cheesecloth is gone, leaving the anti-ideology to function in the open, more brazenly than ever. A political ideology is a set of principles aimed at establishing or maintaining a certain social system. It is a program of long-range action, with the principles serving to unify and integrate particular steps into a consistent course. It is only by means of principles that men can project the future and choose their actions accordingly. Anti-ideology consists of the attempts to shrink men's minds down to the range of the immediate moment, without regard to past or future, without context or memory, above all without memory, so that contradictions cannot be detected, and errors or disasters can be blamed on the victims. In anti-ideological practice, principles are used implicitly and are relied upon to disarm the opposition, but are never acknowledged and are switched at will when it suits the purpose of the moment. Whose purpose? The gang's. Thus men's moral criterion becomes not my view of the good or of the right or of the truth, but my gang, right or wrong. This is what makes today's public issues and discussions so sickeningly false and futile. Most issues rest on so many wrong premises and carry so many contradictions that instead of the question, who is right, one is constantly and tacitly confronted with the question, which gang do you want to support? For example, consider the issue of the war in Vietnam. Everything is wrong about that hideous mess, but not for the reasons which are shouted most loudly, starting from its designation. A cold war is a brazen contradiction in terms. It is not very cold for the American soldiers killed on battlefields, nor for their families, nor for any of us. A cold war is a typically Hegelian term. It rests on the premise that A is non-A, that things are not what they are so long as we don't name them. Or, practically speaking, things are what our leaders tell us they are. And unless they tell us, we have no way of knowing. This sort of epistemology is not working too well, even in regard to the ignorant hordes of Russian peasants. That this should be attempted in regard to American citizens is perhaps the most disgraceful symptom of our cultural disintegration. When men are being killed by a foreign army in military action, it is a war, a whole war, and nothing but a war, regardless of what temperature anyone chooses to ascribe to it. But observe what advantages the Hegelian terminology offers to the leaders of a mixed economy. When a country is at war, it has to use all of its power to fight and win as fast as possible. It cannot fight and non-fight at the same time. It cannot send its soldiers to die as cannon fodder, forbidding them to win. When a country is at war, its leaders cannot prattle about cultural exchanges and about building bridges to the enemy, as our leaders are doing. Trade bridges to bolster the enemy's economy and enable it to produce the planes and guns which are killing our own soldiers. A country at war often resorts to smearing its enemy by spreading atrocity stories, a practice which a free civilized country need not and should not resort to. A civilized country with a free press can let the facts speak for themselves. But what is the moral, intellectual state of a country that spreads smears and atrocity stories about itself and ignores or suppresses the facts known about the enemy's atrocities? What is the moral, intellectual state of a country that permits its citizens to stage parades carrying the enemy's, the Viet Cong's, flag, or to collect funds for the enemy on university campuses? What makes this possible? The claim that we are not allegedly at war, only at cold war. A country's morale is crucially important in wartime. In World War II, the British Lord Haw Haw was properly regarded as a traitor for the crime of trying to undercut the British soldiers' morale by broadcasting scare stories about Nazi Germany's invincible power. In a cold war such as we have today, Lord Haw Haw's job is performed by our own public leaders. The sickening scare stories about escalation, about our fear of war with China, would be morally shameful if indulged in by the leaders of Monaco or Luxembourg. When they come from the leaders of the most powerful country on earth, shameful is not an adequate word to describe their moral meaning. If a country knows that it cannot fight another country, it does not undertake to fight. If a country is actually weak, it does not go into battle screaming, "Please don't take me seriously, I won't go very far." It does not proclaim its fear as proof of its desire for peace. There is only one sense in which that ghastly phenomenon has to be classified as a non-war. The United States has nothing to gain from it. Wars are the second greatest evil that human societies can perpetrate. The first is dictatorship, the enslavement of their own citizens, which is the cause of wars. When a nation resorts to war, it has some purpose, rightly or wrongly, something to fight for, and the only justifiable purpose is self-defense. If you want to see the ultimate suicidal extreme of altruism on an international scale, observe the war in Vietnam, a war in which American soldiers are dying for no purpose whatever. This is the ugliest evil of the Vietnam War, that it does not serve any national interest of the United States, that it is a pure instance of blind, senseless, altruistic, self-sacrificial slaughter. This is the evil, not the revolting stuff that the Vietniks are howling about. None of us knows why we are in that war, how we got in, or what will take us out. Whenever our public leaders attempt to explain it to us, They make the mystery greater. They tell us simultaneously that we are fighting for the interests of the United States, and that the United States has no selfish interests in that war. They tell us that communism is the enemy, and they attack, denounce, and smear any anti-communists in this country. They tell us that the spread of communism must be contained in Asia, but not in Africa. They tell us that communist aggression must be resisted in Vietnam, but not in Europe. They tell us that we must defend the freedom of South Vietnam, but not the freedom of East Germany, Poland, Hungary, Latvia, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Katanga, etc. They tell us that North Vietnam is a threat to our national security, but Cuba is not. They tell us that we must defend South Vietnam's right to hold a democratic election and to vote itself into communism if it wishes, provided it does so by vote, which means that we are not fighting for any political ideal or any principle of justice, but only for unlimited majority rule, and that the goal for which American soldiers are dying is to be determined by somebody else's vote. They tell us also that we must force South Vietnam to accept communists into a coalition government, a process by which we delivered China to the communists, which fact we must not mention. They tell us that we must defend South Vietnam's right to national self-determination, and that anyone upholding the national sovereignty of the United States is an isolationist, that nationalism is evil, that the globe is our homeland and we must be prepared to die for any part of it, except the continent of North America. Is it any wonder that no one believes the pronouncements of our public leaders any longer? Neither the American people nor foreign nations? Our anti-ideologists are beginning to worry about this problem, but in their typical style, they do not say that somebody is lying, they say that there exists a credibility gap. Observe the terms in which the war in Vietnam is discussed. There are no stated goals, no intellectual issues, but there are apparently two opposing sides which are designated not by any specific ideological concepts, but by images, which is appropriate to the primitive epistemology of savages, the hawks and the doves. But the hawks are cooing apologetically, and the doves are snarling their heads off. The same groups that coined the term isolationist in World War II, to designate anyone who held that the internal affairs of other countries are not the responsibility of the United States, these same groups are screaming that the United States has no right to interfere in the internal affairs of Vietnam. Nobody has proposed a goal which, if achieved, would terminate that war, except President Johnson, who has offered $1 billion as the price of peace. Not $1 billion paid to us, but $1 billion paid by us for the economic development of Vietnam, which means that we are fighting for the privilege of turning every American taxpayer into a serf, laboring part of his time for the benefit of his Vietnamese masters. But, demonstrating that irrationality is not a monopoly of the United States, North Vietnam has rejected that offer. No, there is no proper solution for the war in Vietnam. It is a war we should never have entered. To continue it is senseless. To withdraw from it would be one more act of appeasement on our long, shameful record. The ultimate result of appeasement is a world war, as demonstrated by World War II. In today's context, it may mean a nuclear world war. That we let ourselves be trapped into a situation of that kind is the consequence of 50 years of a suicidal foreign policy. One cannot correct a consequence without correcting its cause. If such disasters could be solved pragmatically, i.e. out of context on the spur and range of the moment, a nation would not need any foreign policy. And this is an example of why we do need a policy based on long-range principles, i.e. an ideology. But a revision of our foreign policy from its basic premises on up is what today's anti-ideologists dare not contemplate. The worse its results, the louder our public leaders proclaim that our foreign policy is bipartisan. A proper solution would be to elect statesmen, if such appeared, with a radically different foreign policy, a policy explicitly and proudly dedicated to the defense of America's rights and national self-interests, repudiating foreign aid and all forms of international self-immolation. On such a policy, we could withdraw from Vietnam at once, and the withdrawal would not be misunderstood by anyone and the world would have a chance to achieve peace. But such statesmen do not exist at present. In today's conditions, the only alternative is to fight that war and win it as fast as possible, and thus gain time to develop new statesmen with a new foreign policy before the old one pushes us into another Cold War, just as the Cold War in Korea pushed us into Vietnam. The institution that enables our leaders to indulge in such recklessly irresponsible ventures is the military draft. The question of the draft is perhaps the most important single issue debated today, but the terms in which it is being debated are a sorry manifestation of our anti-ideological mainstream. Of all the statist violations of individual rights in a mixed economy, the military draft is the worst. It is an abrogation of rights. It negates man's fundamental right, the right to life, and establishes the fundamental principle of statism, that a man's life belongs to the state, and the state may claim it by compelling him to sacrifice it in battle. Once that principle is accepted, the rest is only a matter of time. If the state may force a man to risk death or hideous maiming and crippling in a war declared at the state's discretion, for a cause he may neither approve of nor even understand, if his consent is not required to send him into unspeakable martyrdom, then in principle all rights are negated in that state, and its government is not man's protector any longer. What else is there left to protect? The most immoral contradiction in the chaos of today's anti-ideological groups is that of the so-called conservatives, who posture as defenders of individual rights, particularly property rights, but uphold and advocate the draft. By what infernal evasion can they hope to justify the proposition that creatures who have no right to life have the right to a bank account? A slightly higher, though not much higher, rung of hell should be reserved for those liberals who claim that man has the right to economic security, public housing, medical care, education, recreation, but no right to life, or that man has the right to livelihood but not to life. One of the notions used by all sides to justify the draft is that rights impose obligations. Obligations to whom? And imposed by whom? Ideologically, that notion is worse than the evil it attempts to justify. It implies that rights are a gift from the state, and that a man has to buy them by offering something, his life, in return. Logically, that notion is a contradiction, since the only proper function of a government is to protect man's rights. It cannot claim title to his life in exchange for that protection. The only obligation involved in individual rights is an obligation imposed not by the state, but by the nature of reality, i.e., by the law of identity. Consistency, which in this case means the obligation to respect the rights of others, if one wishes one's own rights to be recognized and protected. Politically, the draft is clearly unconstitutional. No amount of rationalization, neither by the Supreme Court nor by private individuals, can alter the fact that it represents involuntary servitude. A volunteer army is the only proper, moral, and practical way to defend a free country. Should a man volunteer to fight if his country is attacked? Yes, if he values his own rights and freedom. A free or even semi-free country has never lacked volunteers in the face of foreign aggression. Many military authorities have testified that a volunteer army, an army of men who know what they are fighting for and why, is the best, most effective army, and that a drafted one is the least effective. It is often asked, but what if a country cannot find a sufficient number of volunteers? Even so, this would not give the rest of the population a right to the lives of the country's young men. But in fact, the lack of volunteers occurs for one or two reasons. One, if a country is demoralized by a corrupt authoritarian government, its citizens will not volunteer to defend it. But neither will they fight for long if drafted. For example, observe the literal disintegration of the Tsarist Russian army in World War I. 2. If a country's government undertakes to fight a war for some reason other than self-defense, for a purpose which the citizens neither share nor understand, it will not find many volunteers. Thus, a volunteer army is one of the best protectors of peace, not only against foreign aggression, but also against any warlike ideologies or projects on the part of a country's own government. Not many men would volunteer for such wars as Korea or Vietnam. Without the power to draft, the makers of our foreign policy would not be able to embark on adventures of that kind. This is one of the best practical reasons for the abolition of the draft. Consider another practical reason. The age of large mass armies is past. A modern war is a war of technology. It requires a highly trained scientific personnel, not hordes of passive, unthinking, bewildered men. It requires brains, not brawn, intelligence, not blind obedience. One can force men to die, one cannot force them to think. Observe that the more technological branches of our armed services, such as the Navy and the Air Force, do not accept draftees and are made up of volunteers. The draft, therefore, applies only to the least efficacious and, in today's conditions, the least essential part of our armed forces, the infantry. If so, then is national defense the main consideration of those who advocate and uphold the draft? The practical question of the country's military protection is not the issue at stake. It is not the chief concern of the draft's supporters. Some of them may be motivated by routine, traditional notions and fears, but on a national scale, there is a deeper motive involved. When a vicious principle is accepted implicitly, it does not take long to become explicit. Pressure groups are quick to find practical advantages in its logical implications. For instance, in World War II, the military draft was used as a justification for proposals to establish labor conscription, i.e. compulsory labor service for the entire population, with the government empowered to assign anyone to any job of its choice. If men can be drafted to die for their country, it was argued, why can't they be drafted to work for their country? Two bills embodying such proposals were introduced in Congress, but fortunately were defeated. The second of those bills had an interesting quirk. Drafted labor, it proposed, would be paid a union scale of wages, in order not to undercut union scales. But in fairness to the military draftees, the labor draftees would be given only the equivalent of army pay, and the rest of their wages would go to the government. What political group do you suppose came up with a notion of this kind? Both bills were introduced by Republicans and were defeated by organized labor, which was the only large economic group standing between us and a totalitarian state. Now observe the terms in which the draft is being debated today. The main reason advanced for the continuation of the draft is not military, but financial. It is generally conceded that the draft is unnecessary, but it is argued a volunteer army would cost too much. As matters stand, the army is one of the lowest paid groups in the country. A drafted soldier's pay in cash or equivalent, i.e. including room and board, amounts to about $1 an hour. To attract volunteers, it would be necessary to offer higher pay and better conditions, thus making an army career comparable to the standards of the civilian labor market. No exact estimates of the cost of a volunteer army have been offered, but the approximate estimate places it at about $4 billion a year. Hold this figure in mind. Hold it while you read about our national budget in the daily papers, and while you hold also, clearly and specifically, the image of what this figure would buy. The years from about 15 to 25 are the crucial formative years of a man's life. This is the time when he confirms his impressions of the world, of other men, of the society in which he is to live, when he acquires conscious convictions, defines his moral values, chooses his goals and plans his future, developing or renouncing ambition. These are the years that mark him for life, and it is these years that an allegedly humanitarian society forces him to spend in terror. The terror of knowing that he can plan nothing and count on nothing, that any road he takes can be blocked at any moment by an unpredictable power, that barring his vision of the future, there stands the gray shape of the barracks, and perhaps beyond it, death for some unknown reason in some alien jungle. A pressure of that kind is devastating to a young man's psychology if he grasps the issue consciously, and still worse if he doesn't. The first thing he's likely to give up in either case is his intellect. An intellect does not function on the premise of its own impotence. If he acquires the conviction that existence is hopeless, that his life is in the hands of some enormous, incomprehensible evil, if he develops a helpless, searing contempt for the hypocrisy of his elders and a profound hatred for all mankind, if he seeks to escape from that inhuman psychological pressure by turning to the beatnik cult of the immediate moment, by screaming, "Now, now, now," he has nothing else but that now, or by dulling his terror and killing the last of his mind with LSD, don't blame him. Brothers, you asked for it. This is what $4 billion would buy. This is what it would spare him and every other young man in the country and every person who loves them. Remember down what drains our money is being poured today. According to the federal budget for fiscal year 1968, we will spend $4.5 billion on foreign aid and allied projects, $5.3 billion on space programs, $11.3 billion on just one of the many, many departments dealing with public welfare, yet we claim that we cannot afford $4 billion to save our youth from the agony of a mangling, brutalizing psychological torture. But of course, the real motive behind that social crime is not financial. The issue of costs is merely a rationalization. The real motive may be detected in the following statement made by Lieutenant General Louis B. Hershey, Director of the Selective Service System, on June 24, 1966. I am not concerned with the uncertainty involved in keeping our citizenry believing that they owe something to their country. There are too many people that think individualism has to be completely recognized, even if the group rights go to the devil. The same motive was made fully clear in a proposal which was advanced by Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara and is now being plugged with growing insistence by the press. On May 18, 1966, Mr. McNamara said the following: "As matters stand, our present selective system draws on only a minority of eligible young men. That is an inequity. It seems to me that we could move toward remedying that inequity by asking every young person in the United States to give 2 years of service to his country, whether in one of the military services, in the Peace Corps, or in some other volunteer developmental work at home or abroad." Developmental work? Devoted to whose development? Apparently planting rice or digging ditches in Asia, Africa, and South America constitutes service to the United States, but preparing oneself for a productive career does not. This book is continued on Disc 9.